Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what the new rule says about when utilities can shut off power during the summer for customers who haven't paid their bills, and putting the Valley's affordable housing problems into context. But first, Governor Ducey is set to sign into law later this morning a bill allowing sports betting in Arizona. That comes after the state Senate approved it earlier this week. It also comes along with new tribal gaming compacts the governor has negotiated. Those were not subject to legislative approval, and details about what's in them have been sparse. But some are starting to emerge, and with me to talk about what they look like is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Hey, Howie.
Good morning. Yes, we managed to unearth something that's been in the works for now 3 years.
So it looks as though there will be some more casinos in Arizona.
Definitely. And this is very interesting because, you know, 20 years ago, the whole fight over expanded gaming was a promise. Well, we won't have any more casinos in the Phoenix area. Well, we found out that that wasn't exactly true because the Tall Autumn kind of pulled a fast one with the last compacts. This time, we know that there are going to be some additional casinos. One of them is yet another Tall Autumn casino, which is going to be around the Loop 303 and Northern Parkway. That is also a result of what was in the original compacts. The Gila River Indian community is also going to get a right to open a fourth casino. That, however, will have to be on tribal land. At least that's what the governor's office assures us. Plus, we know the Pascua-Yaqui tribe is going to get to build a new casino just off of Interstate 10 and Grant Road on some land they own there, but they don't quite have it in reservation status yet. That is sort of a TBA, but they've gotten permission for that. And then on top of that, that means not only, you know, more places to gamble and more machines in those places, but more machines everywhere else. And that's where it gets real interesting.
Yeah, what kinds of new games will be allowed, and how many more machines and tables will be allowed?
Well, right now, there's about 13,600 video gaming machines, call them video slots if you want to, in use in the state. This would allow at least an additional 6,300 video gaming terminals. Then on top of that, they get another 570 every 2 years as an automatic increase. And the tribes that can't use them, then, for example, if you're at the Hualapai and you're at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, you can sell your rights to another tribe that can also use them. As far as the games, we know that there's things like blackjack and poker now at the casinos. That will be expanded, many more tables for that. But they're also getting to play roulette. They're also getting to play baccarat for anybody who has watched enough old James Bond movies to understand what that is and how it's played. And then there's some other games that, truthfully, I had to look up, something called Sicbo, which is some sort of game of chance with three dice. I'm not sure how much demand there is for it, but by George, the compact says you can now do that on tribal gaming lands.
Well, and as you pointed out, Howie, this all comes, you know, amidst the original gaming compacts, which said no new casinos in the Phoenix area. Now, obviously, the compacts are expiring, and there are reasons why they need to be re-upped, but is there an argument? Are folks saying, look, we were promised this when we first voted for this, you know, 20 years ago. We were promised no more casinos in the Phoenix area. And now you're giving us at least four.
Well, a lot of this comes down to, I think, a change in attitude. Remember that they actually started tribal gaming in 92. And I don't know if anybody remembers Linda Akers, who was the U.S. attorney, who sent the FBI agents out to the Fort McDowell Nation to seize their machines, and using the blunt force of Mayflower moving vans. I swear to God, I can't make that up. And then they decided, well, then Fife Symington signed some compacts, and a federal judge said, no, you can't do that, which is what led to the 2002 gaming compact. I think what's happened, though, in the past 20, 30 years is people have become more comfortable with it. I think they recognize that not only is it make it easier than going to Vegas or to Laughlin, but much of this can already be found online. I mean, it's technically not legal to do sports wagering online, which is one of the new things that's going to be offered on and off reservations. But you can do it, you know, despite the geofencing of where your phone or your computer is. So I think people are a lot more comfortable. There's still obviously some concerns about problem gaming and making it a lot easier, but the majority seem to say, well, you know, we're already wagering on things. We can already bet on horses. You can already go out and play blackjack. So what's the difference?
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. You can find him at the One Armed Bandit on any given morning. Howie,
yes,
thank you.
I love the sound effects from those machines.
State utility regulators yesterday approved a new rule on when power companies could disconnect their customers during the summer when those customers haven't paid their bills. 2 years ago, a 72-year-old Valley woman died in her home after her power was cut off. She owed $51. After that, the Corporation Commission put an emergency moratorium on disconnections in place. Once it's finalized, this new rule will replace that. With me to talk about what that'll look like is Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. And Ryan, what were the options on the table and what did the commission ultimately decide to do?
Well, they considered everything under the sun. As they have for the last 2 years, whether to use National Weather Service warnings to set a temperature threshold of 90, 95, or 100 degrees, or to just stick with a seasonal moratorium during the hottest part of the year. It's important that people understand that what is in place this summer as we approach summer in Arizona is the seasonal moratorium, which they passed as an emergency measure 2 years ago after the New Times broke the news that a woman had died after her power was cut. So from June 1 to October 15, the regulated utilities in the state will not be allowed to disconnect people for non-payment.
So it seems as though the commissioners decided against going with the National Weather Service advisory. So what did they ultimately come up with?
So they did approve a new rule that should be in effect next summer, but it's got to go through a rulemaking process. And that is to let utilities choose between using that seasonal moratorium that is, again, in place now, or to use a temperature threshold of 95 degrees. And the amount of data and debate that went into that and to try and reach a consensus where they had at least three votes has just been exhaustive.
Well, so given the fact that, for example, we have already had days that have exceeded 95 degrees and we're only in April, does it seem as though any utilities are going to pick that option as opposed to the seasonal one?
I wouldn't be that surprised if they do, because they have their own strategy for how they go after payment. So maybe there's a utility that would see an advantage in that because they wouldn't have customers who basically write it off through October and say, hey, I don't have to pay because there's no way they can disconnect me until October 15th and I'll just deal with you know, my financial issues at that time. So if you had days that dropped below 95, the utility could then threaten to shut them off. And a lot of this is threatening folks with that disconnection to get them to pay. So it's possible there's a utility that would decide that. But for simplicity, yeah, they probably would just go with that seasonal moratorium.
What was the utility's response to the commission decision?
You know, like always, they say they'll comply with whatever it is that the regulators decide upon. I mean, they have to, essentially. They had concerns beforehand about too long of a moratorium or too low of a temperature threshold that too many people would take advantage of. And, you know, then they have to go after more folks, you know, who are taking advantage of a moratorium to not have their power shut off. So they were trying to be pretty diplomatic on this issue because it involves people dying. But they did share concerns just about the amount of bad debt that they end up with at the end of the season when people haven't been allowed to be shut off and then they have to try and collect that from people. And part of it is just that if you know you're moving out of their territory and that they can't shut your power off for a few months, you might just stop paying before you move away and then they never collect that debt. But the dollar amounts, you know, all the witnesses in there were saying these dollar amounts are pretty low, not enough to worry about, you know, if it's going to save a life. And the utilities, I didn't feel, were pushing back extremely strong on that. They voiced their concerns and more or less let the commissioners debate it. And there was a lot of debate among them.
And for the folks who had been pushing for a permanent rule for something, you know, for the folks, Stacey Champion and others who first brought this to the commission's attention, were they satisfied with what the commission ultimately came up with?
Well, I think they would prefer probably 90 degree threshold. Because 95 degrees is hot, and your house is going to be hotter than 95 degrees if you turn off your air conditioning then. So, you know, their goal, as they stated many times, is zero deaths. And if you really wanted zero deaths, then you wouldn't be shutting people off. But I think what the commission went for was better than some of the options on the table, like just letting the utilities basically choose all the rules. So it was a compromise, as many things are at the Corporation Commission, and a wildly complex one. But I mean, they did definitely gain some ground in the last 2 years. It's a lot of hard work, but they have changed policy in favor of consumers.
So you mentioned that a lot of the evidence presented to the commission suggested that the dollar amounts were not that high for folks who had their power shut off. We should note that the woman who died a few years ago, the balance, I think, was $51, and her power was shut off and she ultimately passed away. Am I right that the commission's rules would also raise the minimum that a customer has to owe before a utility can threaten to shut them off?
Yes, and I believe it's $300 now. So they're not going to be shutting people off for, petty cash. And I don't think, I'd have to go back and look at my notes, I don't think the utility pushed real hard on the dollar threshold. In a way, I think that probably benefits them because they focus on the biggest debts out there. And the key in all of this is that most people, the vast majority of people, eventually pay their bill because it's your air conditioning, it's your electricity, it's your refrigerator to keep food. So the vast majority of customers do eventually pay this debt because they want to continue to live in their homes, and you basically need electricity to do that. So for the utilities, it's a matter of what threat they can hold over customers to get them to do that. And obviously, it's easier to get folks to pay when you can threaten to cut their power off. But even without that threat, they still get folks to pay this debt.
All right. That is Ryan Randazzo, reporter with the Arizona Republic. As always, Ryan, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
The Arizona Supreme Court yesterday said Tucson can continue to hold its elections in odd-numbered years, despite a state law requiring cities to hold their elections in conjunction with federal, state, and legislative ones in even-numbered years. When to hold local elections has been an ongoing fight between the Southern Arizona City and the state legislature. And with me to break down the roots of this fight and what it means going forward is Jim Ninsel, executive editor of Tucson Weekly. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
So this is not the first time a court has said that Tucson can hold its elections basically whenever the heck it wants, right?
Well, yes. They've said the state doesn't have any business messing with the city of Tucson's decisions about when to hold elections, which are governed by the Tucson City Charter, which is not something that the Tucson City Council can just change. They need voter approval for that.
Now, the city holds its elections, its mayoral and council elections, in odd-numbered years. What is their rationale for continuing to do that?
Well, it is in the Tucson City Charter, so that's right there is the main reason. But they also say that because there's so much on the ballot in the even-number years, from the congressional races to the gubernatorial races to the propositions that are on the ballot, that the issues within a city of Tucson get overlooked, that the media is overwhelmed, that the voters, you know, have to sort through enough already. And they think that you actually have a better debate about city specific issues if you hold them in these off years when there isn't other stuff on the ballot.
Now, the argument on the other side, which Republican lawmakers used and talked about when debating this bill, which became a law, is that in odd number years, the turnout is considerably lower.
Yeah, you know, they did make that argument. But, you know, this year at the legislature, you see lawmakers doing everything they can to suppress the vote, you know, to monkey with the early voting system, to make it more difficult to vote early, to all of the stuff that they've got going up there. It doesn't seem like they're that concerned about voter turnout when you look at the legislation that they're pushing. But yeah, that was their argument. I think they just like messing with Tucson. You know, I think there's not much love for Tucson or Pima County up there. And you've seen that with the ways they've tried to shift costs down here, that the governor wouldn't even let us work with FEMA to set up a vaccination clinic for several weeks until it became a big issue. I just think it's just another way that they're trying to mess with the city of Tucson and Pima County.
This is probably a question that we don't have time for all of, but what's up with the animosity between Tucson and Pima County and the state?
You know, we're a bunch of libs down here, and I don't think that sits well with the folks up there in Phoenix or in the Capitol, and they're always trying to figure out ways to make it easier for Republicans to win a Tucson City Council seat down here. It is a big challenge because we have this kind of interesting and unusual election system where you run within your ward in the primary, but in the general election, you run citywide. And there are so many more Democrats down here than Republicans that it's a big challenge for Republicans to win a seat on the Tucson City Council. It's been done. There are moderate Republicans who have won, but those are an endangered species, I think, within the Republican Party right now. And in fact, the Republicans didn't even field candidates for this year's election.
So do you get the sense this will be the last word on this? I mean, there have been rumors that there might be some kind of ballot measure floated for the next year's election. I mean, is this going to end at some point?
Well, you know, they did. But after this law passed, because the council can't just change it on their own, there was a ballot issue here in the city of Tucson that said, hey, do you want to change the charter? And it was defeated. The voters here decided they like the odd numbered elections. So, you know, we'll see if the state tries to cook up something new, like some kind of constitutional amendment or what have you. But I don't know. You know, it gets back to the matter of statewide concern. And are voters across the state really going to care that much about how the city of Tucson runs its elections to pass a statewide measure? I just don't know that's the case.
And to be clear, does this rule only apply to Tucson? I mean, there are other charter cities in the state.
Right. And this went back to a law they passed way back for the 2014 election cycle. You know, the smaller towns used to also do odd numbered elections, or maybe they do elections in the spring instead of the fall. And that law said, hey, everything has to happen in the midterms and the presidential years. And that was when the city of Tucson first sued and won that case back in 2014. So, you know, I just don't know where things go from here, but we'll see.
All right. Jim Nensel, executive editor of Tucson Weekly. Always good to talk to you, Jim. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, as the gaming bill awaits the governor's signature, we ask how once taboo gambling became so normalized in American culture.
Many states do it, frankly, for financial reasons. They don't do it for morality reasons. They don't do it because, hey, it's a lot of fun to bet on sports and people should be able to do it legally. They do it because they want to plug a budget hole.
We'll talk to a gaming historian about mainstreaming of gambling in America. But first, Democrats have spent much of their time at the Arizona Capitol defending the integrity of the November election, all while begging Republicans to do the same. But in most circumstances, it is Republicans continuing to share and spread mistrust with the election process. As KJZZ's Ben Giles reports in part two of the series on the fight over Arizona voting bills, one Republican made an attempt to cut through the noise.
First, it's worth repeating. Arizona's election results withstood the scrutiny of numerous audits, as well as a wave of lawsuits seeking to have the outcome overturned. By all official accounts, the election was fair and accurate. But for those who doubt the results, nothing seems to change their mind. If one theory is proven false, there must be something else. Polling shows those voters are overwhelmingly Republican. So who better to set the record straight than a Republican who has voiced her own election concerns?
I think it's very important for us to be accurate with what we are discussing.
State Senator Kelly Townsend is by no means convinced the election was free of fraud. But in early March, when the latest conspiracy theory about Maricopa County votes emerged from a dumpster, Townsend saw information spreading she knew wasn't true. Stacey Burke is a Pinal County woman who unsuccessfully sued to overturn Arizona's presidential election. She and two others went dumpster diving behind Maricopa County election headquarters and removed what they claim are shredded ballots. Online, Burke also claimed that photos showed ballots from the 2020 election sitting inside loading docks at election headquarters. The photos show open bay doors with a clear view of storage shelves inside county facilities. Townsend still has questions about what Burke found, particularly about shredded ballots.
But if we then make a claim that there are unattended ballots just waiting to be taken on the loading dock of the county recorder's office, then that diminishes what's going on with the shredded ballots.
What Townsend knew for sure, based on previous tours of Election HQ, was that cast ballots aren't kept in the loading bay. So she reached out to the newly elected Maricopa County recorder, Republican Stephen Richer. The senator and recorder met at the loading docks and started rolling on a video she'd later post online. Here's Richer showing Townsend what's in the boxes on shelves inside the dock.
So this is the bay door here that was open. And this is the first set of boxes here, and then there's some over there.
We've got a bunch of blank envelopes here that are used in future elections. We have a lot of affidavits that are with respect to voter registration forms.
Richer then took Townsend further into the building, where the actual ballots cast in 2020 were stored behind locked doors.
That's under 24-hour video surveillance, and only certain people have authorization. For instance, like I just said, my key badge doesn't even authorize me to get into this room.
You should demonstrate that like you did to me. That was kind of funny.
So, do this. I can't even get in there, because those are the 2.1 million ballots from the general election, November 3rd.
It's a short video, roughly 3.5 minutes long. But at last, it seemed, an example of what people like Emily Kirkland, the executive director of Progress Arizona, have been asking of Republicans.
What lawmakers should be doing is what they should have been doing from the beginning, which is telling people, look, this election was conducted as it should have been. This was a totally free and fair process. Our candidate for president didn't win, and that's okay, and we'll come back next time.
Townsend isn't ready to go that far. And judging by comments on her YouTube video, Townsend's followers weren't exactly convinced by her effort. Some acknowledged her fact-checking to prove what was and wasn't stored inside the bay doors. Others weren't satisfied at all and demanded more evidence, like security tapes of the docks and dumpsters. One commenter called the whole thing, quote, complete BS. Townsend said she sympathizes, and she's not sure what more can be done. She's an ardent supporter of the Senate's attempt to audit and recount federal elections in Maricopa County, which she describes as another chance to set the record straight. That audit's drawn plenty of scrutiny for evidence of bias on the part of the Senate's hired auditors. But even so, what if it came up clean? Townsend said the Senate's months-long feud with the county over access to voting materials may have undermined people's belief in the audit.
Even if we had a perfect audit, I don't know that anybody would believe it because of the time that's elapsed.
5 months of election conspiracies may have made it impossible for someone like Townsend, even with credibility among the election's doubters, to change anyone's mind. Ben Giles, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Oak Flat in Pinal County has become the centerpiece of the battles between Native American tribes to preserve their sacred land and mining companies that want to generate revenue and create jobs. Congressman Raul Grijalva has introduced legislation to ban mining at Oak Flat, but its success is uncertain. Washington Post reporter Dana Hedgepath recently wrote about Oak Flat, and its focus was on just how unique and important the sacred land is to the Apache tribe and others. She spoke with my co-host Steve Goldstein.
This land is unlike any others, and many sacred sites fall into the same category. We're not talking about a NIMBY argument here of, you know, not in my backyard, of being like a, you know, a recycling plant here. This is truly, truly sacred. Blessed place. This is where the Apaches and many other tribes believe their creation story started. You can't just pick up and move this land to Kansas or Nebraska and say, oh, there you go. Take your precious historic emery oaks and just replant them. It doesn't work that way. Native people, as you know, are place-based people. It's about the place that we're from.
For people who are actually living there, what does it feel like to have it almost sound like a NIMBY situation? If people who are not informed to say, well, sure, we understand we don't want a mine there, you live there, but come on, you know, it's going to bring money, it's going to bring whatever. Is it hard for folks living there to hear that kind of argument?
Oh, absolutely. Wenzler Knowsley, who's the former chairman of the San Carlos Apache, was in tribal politics for a long time. And last year, he actually moved up into Oak Flat physically instead of just going there weekly, which he did often. He lives in a teepee or traditional housing on the mountain. He just got that into it and cared that much about it. And I think he put it best in my interview with him when he said, everyone lives in a place, right? Regardless if you're white, non-native or native. Imagine someone just coming into your space of the world and saying, oh, we're just going to jackhammer and start digging it up right now. Can you move along? You know, that is a certain kind of hurt. It's offensive. It's disrespectful, right? That is your place. We all have a place. Housing, shelter, a feeling of a place is where people want to be. That's what Oak Flat means to Native Americans. It is not just a place they go to occasionally, but it's regularly used. And to come in and just say, oh, move over. We're going to start digging up land or doing something to it. You know, many Apaches and others that, you know, that's, it's very hurtful. It's very disrespectful, not to mention the long history that we all know of Native Americans being pushed off their land.
And as we mentioned, this is also a coveted piece of land for mining companies. What happened over the last, let's say, 4 years with the Trump administration? And then with Senator John McCain, what he had to do with this in the past, an amendment he attached to a bill. What have we seen shift in terms of the priorities here?
So the biggest thing, as my dad always says, land, no matter what, is valuable because you can't make more of it. And Oak Flat is no exception. It fits that rule very much. It is land. Can't be more of it made. And it's incredibly valuable for what's underneath the surface. It is one of the last and largest untapped reserves of copper in the country. In fact, some say in the world. So there's money to be made there. You know, copper is an industry. It's a money-making industry. It's a needed resource for things that go into cars, plastics. It's needed in the world, and there's a business to be made there. So that's the interest of it for many folks. Over the years, people have known that, and they've wanted to get their hands on Oak Flat. Amazingly, until McCain introduced this rider bill in 2014 that was part of the National Defense Funding Bill, Oak Flat had stayed left alone. It had not been developed in any way for mining. That changed with that bill, just in this rider. He made a deal where it could be exchanged for another 5,000 plus or minus acres in other parts of Arizona. So what's interesting about that is you're making a land exchange, a land swap. It sounds, you know, sort of traditional in a way of what was done hundreds of years ago for Native Americans in treaties, right? And we all know how those ended. So there's a fear that this will end badly for the Native Americans, as many broken treaties have in the past. There are those that support the project, Resolution Copper, that wants to come in and say, hey, look, we need some much needed jobs. Copper is a resource that we need, and we need to figure out a way to do this, to keep parts of the area sacred and also to bring in business. There's certainly an argument to be made for that. I think the past colors what people want to do. There is an inherent fear and nervousness and centuries of evidence that deals with the U.S. government haven't gone well for sovereign Native nations. There's no denying that history.
One of Arizona's Congressman, Raul Grijalva, who's been a big advocate for saving Oak Flat, he's introduced legislation to permanently prevent mining on the land. And there was a subcommittee hearing this week. I'm wondering, did any progress happen at that hearing? Do you have any thoughts about the likelihood that the bill passes?
You know, it's interesting. Oak Flat is getting a lot of attention now. I think that bill, for many people, would say that was a step in the right direction. Will it pass remains to be unknown. Again, what tends to dominate in these sacred sites, not just at Oak Flat, Bears Ears is another example, Taco Canyon is another example. They have a repeated theme, and that's basically a couple of things. Land, you can't create more of it, so therefore it is valuable. They get caught up in politics. And a long history, both for Native Americans and for those who want to develop it. Over and over again, even with preservation laws, federal policies, there are things in place. You would think you know, religious freedom acts are in place to protect people's religious freedoms to practice their beliefs when and where they wish. Even with all these layers, they still fail to either A, be enforced, or B, they're not strong enough. Or this sort of three wheels, as I call them, of valuable politics and money all tend to cloud the issue. And then you end up in court. This has, you know, been playing out for years. Some of these sacred site cases play out for decades, but they very often wind up in the courts because that's the only way tribes and preservationists, Native American activists have found to, that they can slow them down or try to stop them.
That is Dana Hedgepeth. She is a reporter for The Washington Post. We've been talking about her recent piece about Oak Flat here in Arizona. Dana, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The affordable housing crisis is well known across Arizona, but a new analysis from the Urban Land Institute puts the problem into a little more context. The 2021 Home Attainability Index ranks the Phoenix area as one of the 24 least affordable regions of the country. That includes both rental homes and those for purchase. To talk more about this, I'm joined by C.J. Eisenbarth Hager, Director of Healthy Communities with Vitalist Health Foundation, which has partnered with ULI on a number of projects, including the Home Attainability Index. And C.J., it seems as though the news isn't great for the Valley, but also maybe not terribly surprising.
Correct. The purpose of the Home Attainability Index is to give regions a better understanding of how they match up to other metro areas with respect to housing. And so we learned that Phoenix is definitely having some challenges on a number of fronts. It isn't necessarily surprising, as you said, but it confirms what I think a lot of people feel in their gut and see around them, that there are a lot of challenges to a number of folks in finding housing that's affordable, that's safe, that's where they want to be.
So what do we do about that? Because, you know, the supply of affordable housing has been an issue in the Phoenix area for, you know, this is not a new problem. This has been going on for a little while now. And we see lots of new homes and apartments and condos going up, but these are not necessarily what would be considered affordable homes. So what do we do about the fact that there just aren't enough places, you know, that are considered affordable for people to live in?
Well, I think there are a couple of really great conversations happening right now. The city of Phoenix and the city of Tempe are really focusing in on developing housing affordability. They both have housing plans and they both have housing goals around affordability. So I really applaud both of those communities. At the state level, there are two bills making their way through the legislature that could really help with affordability. One is the restoration of the Arizona Housing Trust Fund, which was reduced significantly over the Great Recession. The current bill that is in question would increase the amount of funding to the Housing Trust Fund up to $5 million, which, although that's not quite where it was at the beginning of the recession, it is a step in the right direction. The second bill would establish an entirely new tax incentive that would mirror a federal tax incentive. It's called the low-income housing tax credit. And if both of these particular bills move forward, those would be great additions to adding stock that's more affordable. As you said, we're getting lots of market rate and luxury apartments, and that certainly is a need. But in order to create housing that's affordable to folks who have modest or low incomes, you really need federal subsidy or a tax credit type program to help make sure the rents are at an affordable level.
When you look at the Phoenix area relative to some of the other metro areas in the West, you know, some of those that we are considered to be competing against for firms and jobs and population, how do we stack up in that kind of ranking?
You know, I think, again, there's a couple of things that are working against us. The Great Recession really did hit the construction industry and the building industry particularly hard. So there was a complete stop in the development of housing, particularly housing that was affordable during the Great Recession. other states, while they were hard hit as well, they didn't see the kind of stagnation that Arizona did. The other thing that I think many of the other states in the West have going for them that we don't is that the state governments, California, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico, they all have state programs that help support and drive down the cost of housing so that it's affordable to people with modest means. Arizona, by and large, only has one state program, the Housing Trust Fund, that helps drive down the cost of housing.
As we've talked about, this is not a problem that is, you know, has just sort of crept up on folks. This has been going on for a little while. Is it safe to say that getting out of it will also take some amount of time? Like, you can't just kind of flip a switch, or, you know, even if those two bills were to become law, for example, that doesn't immediately solve the problem, right?
Completely true. And I think that that's a really important comment to elevate, is that this, what we're in right now, is decades and decades in the making. And while we are making some really great strides, it's going to take a really long time to dig ourselves out of this particular hole.
Are there particular cities or metro areas that are doing a particularly good job of these kinds of things? Maybe those that have faced the kinds of challenges the Phoenix area is facing that cities here should be looking at for possible ideas?
I wouldn't point to one. I think many of the approaches would need to be tweaked significantly in order to work in the Arizona and the Valley environment. But in our report, the Urban Land Institute Health, Housing, and Equity report that we released, we looked to other communities and see what they've done and see what could be brought here. One idea that had a lot of traction is the idea of a community benefit agreement. This is the idea of a structured, ongoing conversation between developers and members of the community about what they want to see in a particular development. Oftentimes right now, a developer will try to build housing that's deemed as affordable, and neighbors don't want that particular type of housing. Community benefit agreement allows for this ongoing dialogue, almost a contract, a benefit agreement, as the term says, to negotiate what that could look like. So I think that's one particular idea that's caught on in a number of cities that seems like the idea is ripe for the Valley. Another idea is around community land trusts. With community land trusts, the land is owned by a trust and held in perpetuity. It's leased on an annual basis to an organization that runs or manages or owns the housing. The housing remains affordable, and the land is owned by a trust that manages it separately. So the idea of a community land trust is something that's catching on in a number of places because land is such a big driver for overall cost in developing housing.
CJ Eisenbarth Hager is Director of Healthy Communities with the Vitalist Health Foundation, and you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Later this morning, as we heard, Governor Ducey will sign legislation that will dramatically change gaming or gambling in Arizona. The state's tribal entities will have the opportunity to expand what games they offer, and plans are already in the works to build additional casinos. And visitors will be able to bet on sporting events in those casinos. The state is hoping for hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue. Arguments against the expansion have been either silent or limited, a far cry from decades ago when even the creation of a lottery was seen as something that was immoral and could hurt society. So what changed? My co-host Steve Goldstein asked UNLV's David Schwartz, a gaming historian.
Yeah, and I think the lottery was a big part of it. As we had more and more states adopt lotteries, it was harder for states to argue against it on moral grounds because their citizens could just go over the state lines and buy lottery tickets. And once the state is running a lottery and basically telling people, buy lottery tickets, gamble, it's hard to argue that the state should then tell you, well, it's okay to buy lottery tickets, it's not okay to bet on sports.
Now, there are some people who would cynically say, well, it's because you get to a point of a state needs more money, needs more revenue, and money usually wins out. Is that too cynical?
I don't think so. That certainly is borne out by the history of gambling legalization, where many states do it, frankly, for financial reasons. They don't do it for morality reasons. They don't do it because, hey, it's a lot of fun to bet on sports and people should be able to do it legally. They do it because they want to plug a budget hole. So, yeah, I think money definitely factors into it.
How big a role did organized crime play in gambling and in gaming? And is that going to be, have we seen that basically be lessened? And are we going to see that even less so as more and more states expand?
Well, going back to the 19th century, when gambling was illegal in most places, organized crime had a huge role because by definition, gambling is organized and was illegal, so it was a crime. You know, you did see a lot of folks who were involved with Prohibition move into gambling after Prohibition ended. And some of them ultimately ended up in Las Vegas, where they went more or less legit running casinos. You know, that generation obviously isn't with us anymore, so organized crime isn't involved directly in owning casinos. If you look at things like sports betting, organized crime has been involved with that in the past, but it's more on the money lending side and more on the, you know, basically financial services side, if you want to call it that, rather than actually picking winners and losers.
To what extent do you think Las Vegas, Visitors and Convention Authority, marketing, et cetera, contribute to this in the sense that, you know, it's almost like, well, we all like to have a good time every once in a while. So, you know, what's wrong with letting your hair down a little bit? How much of that mastery impacted the rest of the country?
I think Las Vegas did have a big impact on the rest of the country because they showed that you could have casinos in a city and the city could grow and it wouldn't be completely dysfunctional. And I think that's one of the things that led to other states adopting it. You know, certainly when New Jersey approved casinos for Atlantic City in 1976, they were specifically looking at Las Vegas and saying, we want to replicate that kind of growth for a tourist destination. And I think other cities have looked at it to some extent too.
Do you think other states having these opportunities is going to actually put a real dent in Las Vegas? Or is Las Vegas established in a way that it offers so many other things that it won't? Or is Las Vegas going to have to innovate in some ways? Is it already doing that?
Well, I think Las Vegas has been facing that kind of competition for gambling since the 80s, and they've done okay. But it's worth saying that Las Vegas really isn't mostly about the gambling anymore. You know, since 1999, the big casinos in the Strip have made more money from non-gambling stuff, from the hotel rooms, from the meals, from the shows, than they have from gambling itself. And you've seen as gambling has grown around the country, it hasn't grown quite as quickly in Vegas, but the revenue, the money that they make from other areas has grown quite a bit more.
Let me ask you, as we moved forward with technology, and that includes where, you know, a lot of younger people are used to seeing DraftKings or whatever it is on an app on their phone, does that change the attitude generally of how gambling and gaming are seen?
I think having things in phones does make it more accessible, but I think in some ways for sports betting, at least, this might be a bit of a throwback where it used to be people doing it in person and now they're doing it mediated with technology. So I think it's an evolution and I think it can make it more accessible in a lot of cases.
We know how baby boomers and Gen Xers generally feel about gaming. Let's say with normal March Madness, maybe a bunch of them would go to Vegas to watch the games and, you know, bet on the Final Four and that sort of thing. How do you anticipate that changing with millennials, Gen Zs, that sort of thing?
Well, I think a lot of it is going to be predicated on how much money they have. So if they're not making as much money as the baby boomers did, they're not going to have as much discretionary income. You know, that being said, they could just have a totally different attitude towards it. It could become much more common. It's not like back in 1970 when, you know, making a trip for Vegas was something you could save for and plan for. You know, and you would gamble there. Now, pretty much people have a lot more opportunities to gamble, so they can make it a part of their everyday life if they want.
Conversing with a colleague earlier today, and we were wondering about just the mainstream aspect of gaming, as we're going to see more of it in our arenas and in our stadiums. And his example was marijuana, that marijuana was one of those things that was considered to be, you know, if we go back many, many years, like reefer madness, but now it just seems like part of the mainstream. Do you see that gaming is more and more becoming part of just sort of something that almost everybody can do? And if they do it, really no judging?
I think it is. I think if you look at the National Football League's attitudes towards gambling and towards Las Vegas, you can see that evolution happen. You know, it was maybe 10 years ago that Las Vegas Visitors and Convention, or Convention and Visitors Authority, wanted to buy an ad during the Super Bowl, and the league said no. And the ad wouldn't have mentioned gambling, just would have said, come to Las Vegas. And, you know, now there's an NFL team in Las Vegas. The teams of the league are very comfortable partnering with gambling operators. So they've done a complete 180. So I think you see a lot of cases of that.
And does that feel like a natural evolution to you?
I wouldn't say it's natural. It's definitely an evolution. You can see society becoming more open to gambling than it was once before. It's becoming much more mainstream.
And that was Steve Goldstein speaking with UNLV's David Schwartz. He is a gaming historian. Much more on sports betting and the gaming compacts tomorrow morning on the show. Our Friday newscap panelists will analyze that story as well as the rest of the week's top stories. We'll also find out why pandemic-inspired porch concerts in one Phoenix neighborhood have been shut down. That and a lot more tomorrow morning right here on the show. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody for Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening today.